You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Gari Matai won the 2004 Nobel Peace Prize for grassroots environmental movement she launched in her native Kenya, her Greenbelt Initiative, which paid rural women to plant trees to restore depleted forests. In her latest book, The Challenge for Africa, Ms. Matai argues that similar grassroots movements working from the bottom up rather than from the top down might be the best way to address Africa's intractable problems like hunger, environmental degradation, corruption, and political violence. Her book is published by Pantheon. I'm very pleased that it brings Wangari Matai back to the show today. Hello.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
You've said that the disempowerment of ordinary people underlies Africa's gravest problems. Why does it matter whether ordinary people feel powerful?
It's very important for people to feel that they can do things, that they can think for themselves, that they can change their lives, and not to be so dependent on their leaders or on the systems. Because whatever governments can do, citizens must do their part.
Well, that lack of power by ordinary citizens has allowed the governments to operate with impunity. But how has that even happened? Did they just cede the power to political leaders? Is it based on something cultural that goes back a long time?
I think part of it, to understand this, sometimes it appears like lethargy, sometimes it appears like ignorance, giving
passivity.
Up. Yes. I think that one would need to go back to the colonial legacy and realize that during the colonial times, the African people were very much oppressed. And given the impression that they cannot do things for themselves, the colonial administration had to think for them, then they were introduced into a new system of education that actually encouraged them to think that the life they led before was useless, and they have to learn all over how to deal with things and how to manage their lives, and in many ways became very dependent on those managers. Now, when we became independent, our own leaders followed the same system, did not change to empower their people, and in many ways took advantage of the ignorance, took advantage of the willingness to believe in the leadership. I don't think it is so much in the culture. We tend sometimes to think that Africans depended very much on their leaders. It's not quite true always. But I think that you can encourage people to become dependent on the leaders.
But you've also said that we should not lay too much blame on the legacy of colonial rule, that that's become a kind of an easy scapegoat.
Precisely. I think that 40 years, 50 years since we became independent, and when you think about it, we were only colonized for about 8 years, barely 100 years, therefore. So we cannot continue to blame that on the legacy of colonialism. We have been independent for 40 years in Kenya. We ought to have sorted out our problems and invested in the future. We haven't, and we have tended to always go back to colonialism and put our excuses there.
But one thing about colonialism that we can't escape is that it created these arbitrary borders.
Precisely. Now, those are some of the legacies that are, of course, very unfortunate. But again, these are the legacies that Africans should be able to deal with, especially at the level of the African Union. You remember that when many of the African states were established and they became independent, they met in Addis Ababa. And they agreed that they would embrace the colonial boundaries that they inherited. They should also have, for example, decided that they will go back home and they will encourage the different communities. In my book, I call them micronations. Quite often we refer to them as tribes. Leaders should have gone back home and they should have encouraged these communities to learn to live together, to take advantage of the fact that they now live in one nation. Never mind, it was artificially created, but now they're there. And to survive in the new world order, they needed to work together. What did we have instead? Is leaders who took advantage of those divisions and spinned them and made them their cards for negotiating political power.
There are a lot of micronations, what you call micronations, Throughout Africa, in Nigeria, there are 250, in Cameroon, 200. Your country, Kenya, has 42. And in the case of Cameroon, isn't that complicated further by the fact that it's the merging of a former British and French colony, and there's been tension between the Francophone and Anglophone groups as well?
I think all those differences on the based on of culture or languages of European powers is really an indication of the weakness of the African leadership, because to be divided because we are either Anglophones or Francophones is to me unbelievable. The African leadership should be able to get over that, because after all, you are not Anglo and you are not Franco. Therefore, they should have been able to get over that and deal with the issues in their own countries. It's just an excuse.
Well, it seems like it's created another tribal division. On top of the 200 different cultures you have there, you then have the French speakers and the English speakers, or the people who live in the French, former French area and the former English area. And there's that seems to have been where the power struggle has really occurred in Cameroon.
You get it right, because it created now, instead of the tribes, as we would call them, or micronations, as I refer to them in my book, you create a tribe of the educated, who therefore speak these European languages. They are also the people who have the power. They are the people who have the wealth. And this represents not more than, at most, 20% of the populations in the country. And then you have the rest who don't speak any of these languages, are therefore deemed primitive, uneducated, economically and politically, economically almost useless, except when you want to exploit them, and politically useful when you need them for the vote.
But what about those different groups? Do they all have separate languages? Are the languages at least similar when one, whether you want to call it a microculture or whether you want to call it a tribe, lives in proximity to the next one?
Well, you know, the truth of the matter is some countries, of course, some regions are a bit more fortunate than others in the sense that they have a lingua franca. In East Africa, we have Kiswahili. In West Africa, they have Hausa. It is quite possible. In the Northern Africa, as you know, they have Arabic. It is quite possible for visionary leaders to find a common language or to do what the South Africans did. The South Africans embraced at least nine of the languages of their major micronations in order to bring as many people within the government and within the national identity as possible. Of course, it is expensive, and I'm not saying that it is easy for South Africans, but considering that we have been fighting corruption, stealing from the state, and considering that Africa is not poor, Africa has many, many resources. If these leaders were really we're not greedy, we're not corrupt, we're managing the resources in a responsible way, it would be possible for them to create this lingua franca. When you look at a visionary leader such as Julius Nyerere of Tanzania, for example, he was able to encourage his people. It wasn't easy to embrace Kiswahili. And today, if you go to Tanzania, you find a greater national cohesion than you find in Kenya.
My guest is Wangari Maathai, who has written a new book called The Challenge for Africa. It's published by Pantheon. In Kenya, the language that the official language, the language of government, is English, isn't it? In many of these countries, it's the language of the former colonizer, French, Portuguese, English.
Precisely, because the people to whom, and this is very important, I always say that I truly admired China when China was getting Hong Kong back. I followed that transition very closely, and I noticed that the Chinese had deliberately prepared people who were going to take over in Hong Kong. In many African countries, the people who really took over had been prepared by the colonial powers. They spoke that language. They embraced and adored the lifestyle that that was being lived by the colonial administrators. And so we really had for all practical purposes, a change of guards. And so what language would those people speak? The language of the people they admire and want to emulate. And so the national language became the language of the colonial masters. And in some cases, like in East Africa, the national language, the official language became the colonial master language. And the official language is a national language like the national language is Kiswahili. So if you come to Kenya and you enter into an office, you will be addressed in English. Now imagine an ordinary person in the rural areas coming into a government office and being addressed either in English or in Kiswahili. He or she does not understand any of those languages. They feel alienated. And that is why sometimes it's so easy for them to be persuaded by their politicians to identify themselves with a micronation rather than with a nation. And also, if you listen to the politicians in Africa, when they seek for votes, when they talk to their people during political campaigns, they don't talk to them in those foreign languages. They talk to them in the mother tongues. So it is very unfortunate that this leadership, the leadership in Africa, instead of really working for the African people, working for the good of the people, they have continued almost a colonial culture over and above the a colonial culture on their people. It's as if colonialism never ended.
It's one of the reasons that it's even hard to create any kind of sense of national art. Ousmane Sembène, the great Senegalese filmmaker, told me that when he first made a film in Senegal, he made it in French, and when he brought it around to the villages, all of the villagers said, "Well, why have you made this movie in a language we don't speak? Why didn't you make it in Wolof?" And
precisely.
So he started making films in various indigenous languages, but the problem is that you have a very limited audience. You suggest in the book that African children be taught three languages, their own, an international language, and the language of one of the micronations in their country.
I think this would probably be a greater investment than than the current preaching to children or to young people that we should end colonialism. When you speak the language, you feel closer to the people who speak that language. You are not alienated. And I think it would break the barriers that are currently there between the micronations. And if, for example, one was to speak a micronation the language of a micronation that is very distant from their own. In Kenya, for example, I'm a Kikuyu. And if my child was to learn English and learn Kiswahili and learn Kikuyu, but also learn Luo, for example, now they would break a lot of blocks that today separate Luo children from Kikuyu children, because there are no books. There are no stories. There is no communication between those two communities. But there is a lot of propaganda that is generated, especially by politicians and propagandists, one against the other. And yet, there is no communication between them.
Is that what happened in Kenya after the 2007 elections, when 1,500 people died, thousands were injured, 500,000 people were forced to flee their homes over what has been described in our newspapers as tribal violence?
Well, it can be considered tribal violence, but I think that for those who follow Kenya's politics, these are activities that had been going on since 1991, 1997. This is a classic example of where politicians take up those micronations and they use them. They pick up an issue that is very volatile. For example, in this case, they took the land and used the issue of land and land distribution and land ownership, a situation that goes back to the colonial period when the British took a lot of this land, and when they left, they passed it on to whoever could buy, and the majority of those who could buy were the people in power. And today, politicians use these issues to really create passion and hatred against the communities. Now, I would say that what happened in Kenya did not surprise me personally. Many people say they were surprised. I was not. I had been following, and part of our work had been to show that if there is not democratic system of governance, is if there is not accountable governance, if there is not respect for human rights, if there is not equitable distribution of resources, sooner or later there is discontent, and politicians then take this discontent and spin it and use it as a political card.
Well, it wound up with threats against you, didn't it? After the violence subsided, you encouraged the president, Mwai Kibaki, to engage his opponent, Mr. Odinga, in dialogue, and he reacted to your suggestion by withdrawing all of your bodyguards. And then you texted a message, you received a text message that threatened your life.
Yes, I think that was a classic example of what happens when you try to be a nationalist or to occupy a middle road. As far back as 2003, I had raised an objection in the government because I was part of the government, and I had said that the commitments and the promises we had made to some of our colleagues, especially Raila Odinga and his team, we had failed to carry out the promise. And as a result, there was a crack developing within the government, and I warned that this crack would likely destabilize the government. Eventually, we went to a constitutional making process, which was part of what we had promised, but we could not agree because we had already broken the promises that we had made in 2002. Eventually, of course, I was sacrificed because I was criticizing President Kibaki, because I am a Kikuyu. I come from the Kikuyu community. Kibaki is a Kikuyu. And so I'm expected not to criticize him, not because, purely because he comes from Micronation. And because he comes from Micronation, I have to support him no matter what.
Tribal loyalty.
Tribal loyalty, which does not promote good governance. And as a result, I would say part of what we experienced last year was as a result of that tribal loyalty, whether it was people demonstrating their loyalty to Kibaki or people demonstrating their loyalty to Raila. It was really just fighting for what I would call the warlords.
And the situation remains tense, doesn't it?
It remains very tense. As you know, I understand even while I was traveling, the Minister for Justice and Constitutional Affairs, who was expected to lead the reforms that are desperately needed by the country, has resigned, and others have followed her. I am not in many ways surprised, but it is probably not for the good of the country. This is probably a realignment of politicians again, so that they put themselves in positions where they can acquire power come 2012, which is going to be our next general election.
And I'll ask you later whether you think you're going to run for president again. But right now, I want to inform everyone I'm talking with Wangari Maathai, who is the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize and the author of a number of books, the most recent, The Challenge for Africa, published by Pantheon. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Wangari Maathai, whose latest book is The Challenge for Africa. It is published by Pantheon. We're talking about tribal violence. We have seen terrible violence that can result from conflicts between what you call the micronations. The Western media often do say that they are based on ancient tribal animosities, but you said that explanation really isn't accurate.
It's not accurate because I think that there is an over-exaggeration of the way Africans lived prior to colonial era, about a little over 100 years ago now. Everybody was not at war with each other. Everybody knew where the land was, where their rights were. But it is true that we did not have nations as we have them now. Most people know how the nations in Africa were created. And obviously, we did not create the nations the way they have been created in, say, in Europe, where nations, after many years of fighting, decades of fighting, they eventually would come together, draw up their lines and make treaties and keep going. But today we see a Europe that is now more united and they are breaking down their borders. It's just amazing to see what is happening.
On the other hand, we've seen Yugoslavia fall apart. Right now Belgium is going through a serious problem because of the two micronations there.
Yeah, and when you look at it, you'll see that it requires for those micronations to sit down together, for the politicians to be honest with each other and realize that, of course, it is a very different situation. You can still be a micronation in Europe, within Europe, but alone, they would not have survived at a time when Europe was having wars between the different micronations.
So why do we have this more violent situation in Africa? Liberia was torn apart for years, the Ivory Coast, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Zimbabwe, Rwanda, Sudan, Somalia, Sierra Leone. Nobody seemed to be willing to share power. Instead, they just would fight to the death.
Yes, I think that it is a very complex issue. And what I try to say here in the book, Challenge for Africa, is that it's not a one-way track, that there are so many issues that African leaders have to balance with. They have to deal with the colonial legacy, which they can't get away from. But as I say, it's not an excuse. They have to deal with the poverty. They have to deal with the fact that they are managing communities that have very little education, very little skill, no capital. They came to borrow from the West, and they borrowed in such a way that their nations have become deeply indebted, so that quite often they are unable to pay the debt and at the same time provide essential services to their people. And as a result, for many years, they were liable to being overthrown by the armies. Now it is not the armies. Now it is themselves fighting among themselves. So it is not, it is a very complex issue. And what I would really like to see is to see the African leadership, maybe not all of them, but a few of them at least, recognizing this complexity and really sitting down and deciding that they are better off creating peace in Africa so that they can concentrate on development rather than engaging in wars that take them nowhere. They don't make today's wars are fought in Africa not by bows and arrows, but mostly by guns, which they don't make. So it is going to take visionary leadership so that these leaders decide, first and foremost, let us remove certain issues that are holding us back. One of them is the wars. The conflicts in Africa have been terrible. Secondly, is the protection of resources so that they are not exploited and given away at pittance when Africans are left poor. Secondly, they must end corruption so that we manage what we have with greater accountability. And then we would begin to move. The greed, the selfishness, and the short-sightedness of the leaders that we have is what is making it very difficult for them to get out of this murky ground. They must recognize that they have a murky ground, and they must get out of it and start managing from outside, not while they are inside.
My guest is Wangari Maathai, whose latest book is The Challenge for Africa. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Wangari, we have a caller from Togo who would like to join in this conversation.
Okay, great.
Is he on the line? Hello.
Hello.
Hi, what's your name?
My name is Elias.
And you're living in the Bronx these days?
Yes, I'm living in the Bronx.
What do you want to tell Ms. Maathai?
No, I just bought her book yesterday. I mean, it's a great book.
Okay.
Hello?
Yes. And
yeah.
Anything else? We have limited amount of time.
Yeah. I just want to ask a quick question regarding the Africa. Africa is a continent.
Africa is a continent.
Right. And then, you know, the major problem we have is the free trade in agricultural products. You know, we don't have a free trade. For instance, I'm from Togo. If I want to go to Kenya and do, like, trade or business or something like that, I need a visa or, you know, whatever it is. We don't have a free access to our own country. How is it possible that we can do? You know, I couldn't agree with her more. Like, when it comes to the continent, we have to do, you know, take our own destiny. But we don't have a free access to our own countries, and then it's not working. How can we, you know, support ourselves if we can trade the basic products we have?
Well, I think you are very right at us, and I would say that that's an issue that I know is being addressed by both by the regional leaders. As you know, in West Africa, they have ECOWAS. In East Africa, we have East African Community. In South Africa, they have COMESA. There are these regional trading blocks. And what the African Union is doing is encouraging the building of these regional blocks even before they can have a continental unity. So it's up to us to see if we can do the right thing. Part of the problems why we do not have visas open, as you know, there is a discussion even over the visas. And I know, for example, in East Africa, it's much better now than a few years ago. You can cross over in East Africa without a visa. So they are breaking the borders, but it is going very slowly because we also have demonstrated a certain amount of irresponsibility. We go to these countries, and the first thing we want to sell are drugs. Or do illegal businesses, and so, or do money laundering that we have acquired through corruption. So these are some of the challenges that the African Union is facing, and also these regional bodies.
And there are regional conflicts. Somalia and Ethiopia and Eritrea are at war. If we're just talking about East Africa and West Africa, for a while, Liberia was involved in Sierra Leone, and we can go on and on and on.
Precisely.
You have pointed out that the traditional African healer or medicine man played an important role in the community. He took on the role of counselor and helped people resolve mental health issues, and that the general disappearance of them has been a great loss.
As in many situations of traditional knowledge, we all know that every community has evolved through all these thousands of years and have acquired a certain amount of knowledge that helped that community to survive. Otherwise, they would have gone like the dinosaurs. And whatever was that helped them survive should not have been thrown out like it was useless, or be considered witchcraft, or be considered devilish. I think there was an over-enthusiasm by the missionaries. And so they threw away, as you would say, the baby with the bathwater.
So how do we balance things? You would suggest that Africans should try to recapture the culture that existed in pre-colonial days. On the other hand, they have to adapt new ways of doing things like farming. Bring in Western technology so that there can be some progress in these countries.
Yes.
They have to electrify.
Yeah, I think it is a matter of balance. And unfortunately for us, partly because the transition was supervised by a colonial administration that was more keen to transform us so that we could be more useful to them rather than to really help us move into the 20th century, we ended up losing everything that we had known before. And now we are looking back and we are recognizing that, yes, what we have acquired has been wonderful. I am very happy that I am a modern African girl. I can read and write. I can write books. I have been highly educated. I am the better for that. And I would have liked much more, many more of us to be in this position. But at the same time, I would be richer if I did not lose everything that my forefathers had acquired in the form of traditional knowledge and which helped them to survive. But perhaps we would be very respectful of nature. Perhaps we would be very respectful of rivers, of trees, of the land, that we would probably have protected our seeds. And perhaps today we would not be starving because there is drought and all the maize has failed, because we would have had millet, maybe we would have had sorghum and roots and such. There is so much knowledge that we should not have lost.
Well, there's degradation of the land now, you
precisely
say.
Because now we have come to believe so much in modern life that sometimes we go overboard. We want to think that whatever our forefathers practiced was not right. Right now, as I speak in Nairobi, we are having a campaign trying to tell people, do not cultivate near the rivers. You would think that now that we have been educated, we're speaking good English, we would protect the rivers, we would protect the wetlands, we would protect the forest, because we understand the role these play in our lives. But we are so disconnected and so focused on money and the comfort of today that we have lost even the wisdom that our forefathers had without the knowledge that we now have.
And then there's the brain drain, isn't there? That caller was from Togo. He lives in the Bronx. Many of Africa's smartest people have emigrated to foreign countries for education or business opportunities.
That is
right.
And
they don't go back home.
That is right. And it is partly the reason, as we were saying earlier, that when leaders destroy the country, of course, people who have something to sell, they will go to where they can sell it. And Africa is left without skill, without knowledge that it desperately needs. But you're not going to keep those people there if you do not have a country where they can feel that they can use the potential that they now have.
You write in the book, the challenge for Africa is a call for genuine leadership that puts people's welfare first, places the environment at the center of development, and maintains a vision of the future founded on justice and sustainability. It seems almost utopian in the light of the current situation.
It really looks like utopia, yes. But I want to see one country that has made advancement that does not have aspects of what I have mentioned there. And any country that has ignored them, that has nevertheless progressed. The truth of the matter is, that is what we would all like to see in every country. We know that no country in the world is perfect, but at least most countries that we consider successful and where the citizens are living a better quality of life and a dignified quality of life are people who have aspired to follow some of those values. And even though they are not at the top, they are somewhere, they are not going backwards, and they are not deliberately ignoring them as we do in many of our countries in the region.
Another caller from Guinea says that African countries accept Western money for aid and then are so corrupt it never gets to the people. Unfortunately, we can't address that right now, but that's something that we will discuss quite a bit tonight when we continue our conversation. We'll be talking again tonight at 6:30 at the Cooper Union at 7 East 7th Street, and that is free. Isn't it?
Well, that is true, and that is partly why I was very much part of the global campaign to cancel the debts in the year 2000, and I'm sure many people who are listening were part of that campaign. And you remember we collected over 17 million signatures. We still didn't succeed, but at least they introduced the HIPIC initiative, and some of the countries have been assisted. But the truth of the matter is, again, we go back to leadership. It's the leadership. Every country needs to borrow. No country has enough money. Even mighty America sometimes has to borrow money from somebody.
But China,
it is how that money is used to ensure that it is put into good use so that you can pay that money back without sacrificing the quality of life of your people.
Wangari Maathai was elected to Kenya's parliament in 2002. In 2003, she was appointed Assistant Minister for Environment, Natural Resources, and Wildlife. She is the author of the memoir Unbowed, and now The Challenge for Africa, which is published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you. So kind of you to have me, and thank you for those of you who are listening to us.